from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, on July 1st, new federal regulations went into effect to make your child's school lunch more nutritious, like adding additional fresh fruits and vegetables. After the usual pizza and chicken nuggets, it sounds like needed change, but are schools ready? According to research from California Watch, 60% of schools in the state have trouble meeting the old nutrition requirements. How will they get up to speed? Forum is next. Join us right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. In 1946, the United States Congress created the National School Lunch Program to diminish malnutrition and to make use of agricultural surpluses. Presently, the $10.8 billion program serves about 32 million lunches annually, and that's almost two-thirds for free or at a lower price for low-income students. How nutritious are school lunches? Here in California last year, schools received about $1.3 billion in federal aid to administer lunch programs, and a California Watch analysis showed that 60% of school lunches reviewed by the state over the past 5 years failed to meet at least one food nutritional requirement. The new federal regulations began the 1st of July, and they include limits on such things as fat and salt, as well as mandates for larger portions of fruits and vegetables, and an increase in whole grains. This opening hour of Forum, we want to focus our attention on school lunches and the Healthy Hunger Free Lunch Program. That's Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. Janie Thornton is joining us first. She's Deputy Undersecretary for the USDA's Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, which oversees the administration of the National Schools Meals Program. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you with us. And let me begin by asking you about these new nutritional requirements. Maybe give us just a general sense of what they mean as opposed to the old ones.
Well, we are very excited. This is the first time in about 30 years that we have had a substantial change to our meal pattern, or what we really offer to children each and every day. In the new patterns, we will see, as you mentioned earlier, an increase in fruits and vegetables. We will have all of our grains, whole grains. We will have not only minimums, but also maximum on calories. We're reducing the sodium, sugar, fat in foods. So overall, healthier meals for kids.
And also 6 cents for those who, that is 6 pennies, for those who fulfill these obligations, right?
That's correct. Once a school district has menus planned, their cycle menus, and they are approved by the state and certified that they do meet the new standards, then they will be eligible beginning October 1 for 6 cents for every school lunch that they serve.
What about keeping up to speed? I mentioned in my introduction that 60% of schools have not been able to do that here in California, and California is actually leading the nation. So expectations there, these are more difficult requirements in many ways than the previous ones.
Well, they are more difficult in many instances, but we also know that there are many, many schools per se, across the country that are almost there. So they could have been a percentage of a point off of what the former requirements were, and they would not have met. So many are much, much closer than perhaps statistical information might show you, but there are some districts and some schools in those districts that may have still a challenge, quite a way to go to meet the new standards.
A challenge particularly because many of those kitchens, just from what I've been reading, are not up to snuff, and there's not enough time often for kids. They get about 25, 30 minutes to eat, and they have long lunch lines.
That's true, and that's where it takes not just folks in the school nutrition arena, but the entire school as a whole and really the community to prioritize, to say, We need a kitchen that we can prepare healthy food in. Our children do need more time to eat the healthy foods. So it's going to take a push, not just what we're doing in a school cafeteria, but really beyond that.
We're talking to Janie Thornton, who's with us from her office in Washington, D.C., and is Deputy Undersecretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, which oversees the administration of the National School Meals Program. And speaking of overseeing, Ms. Thornton, I know these visits happen roughly about, or have been happening roughly about once every 5 years. Now they're down to once every three, but there's not been necessarily, well, full conformity to those. By which I mean, in other words, not all the monitoring that's supposed to be done is getting done. And what is going to be new about that?
Well, our states are responsible for doing the monitoring. They actually sign an agreement with USDA. These are the guidelines that they will follow. And then the states are checked by our regional offices, and then regional offices where there are issues or problems do report that to us at the federal level, and we would then do perhaps a federal audit. There are random federal audits done periodically out in states by USDA currently, and that same process will continue. Again, with all encouragement, trying to improve programs as we move forward.
Does improvement mean there's not going to be paste in pizza counting as a vegetable serving, or pink slime beef that people are so concerned about? I mean, how are these lunches going to really change specifically?
Well, I think you will find that there probably have been very, very few school districts that actually would have counted the tomato paste on a pizza as a vegetable component. We will be offering many, many fruits and vegetables for our children, but obviously children need to make those selections. And what is even more critical than making the selections, they need to actually consume them. So not only do we need to work in schools, we need to work outside of schools. Schools can be part of the solution, but if we actually are going to change the eating habits of kids, which will result in better eating habits of America as a whole, everybody's got to take a part of that responsibility.
You're talking about an alliance between the schools and the community and the homes, obviously.
Absolutely, and wherever children eat, and we need to be setting good examples for our children in wherever they might be, whether it's in church, in organizations outside of school or in school or in the home.
Well, nearly a third of U.S. children are presently overweight or obese, as I'm sure you're well aware. And this is designed, and I know the First Lady had a lot to do with it as well as USDA, to ameliorate that problem.
Absolutely. And, you know, our problem comes not just from what we're eating, but it's portion sizes and it's amounts that we're eating. We have changed portion sizes over the last 20 or 30 years until we think that it's normal to eat, you know, a 20-ounce steak if you go out.
Supersize
to eat,
me.
Or, yeah. Yes. And so we've got to change that mindset everywhere we go.
You're also changing the caloric intake. How does that going to work?
Well,
we've
never had maximum calories listed before, and we will have that now. So actual planned menu will not only have minimum but also maximum amounts of calories, and within that maximum amount, it has to have certain food components. We are trying to teach children, like our new food icon does, that half our plate should be fruits and vegetables, and we need to be eating more of those foods than typically children eat today, or adults for that matter.
Janie Thornton, again, is Deputy Undersecretary of USDA's Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, and we thank you so much for joining us on Forum this morning.
Well, thank you so much. It was great to be here.
And Janie Thornton joined us from the nation's capital. Eleanor Yang Su is now joining us from San Diego. She is a contributor for California Watch, and we're good to have you. It's good to have you with us, Eleanor Yang Su. Welcome.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
There are a lot of challenges in meeting these requirements. Research showed, as I indicated earlier, that we only have a 60% conformity rate here in California. So let's talk about what Californians need to do specifically.
So the biggest problem areas that California schools need to work on, at least from the experts that I spoke to, is cutting back on their saturated fats and really working to reduce their sodium. The saturated fat levels, I know your last guest had said that in a lot of cases schools were just, 1% or a little bit over, but when I looked at the distribution on the saturated fats, there were quite a large number. I think maybe 20% of the schools that were in violation of that were actually significantly over, like maybe 15 or 20% over the saturated fat cutoff. So a lot of folks are saying this is something where schools really need to focus in on. The sodium as well. 80% of school districts had exceeded the recommended sodium levels, which is, a huge figure, and that's going to be one that they're going to need to work hard to cut back on.
Is this figure of an additional 6 cents per lunch really enough to get up to regulatory standards?
Some of the districts that I spoke to said definitely not. One of the districts in San Diego said that their typical fruit or vegetable serving costs just 18 to 20 cents per lunch. So the 6 cents isn't going to pay nearly what they need for, the fruits and vegetable requirement. Other districts said that they think it's more doable, but I think it really depends on the student population. If you end up having more students who qualify for free or reduced price lunches, then you end up getting more federal funding. So there's a lot of different factors that go into it.
Well, despite the problems here in California, California is a national leader, and legislators have put a ban on trans fats, and there's more produce from local farms. In fact, Berkeley is kind of the shining example in this state.
Yeah, I was so impressed when I learned about what they were doing in Berkeley. They were serving meats that had been from grass-fed cows, and they were serving a lot of organic fruits and vegetables, and virtually everything that they make is made from scratch, which is very unusual. They're definitely one that a lot of schools look to, but I think it's difficult when you don't have as much money to work with as Berkeley. A lot of the school districts said that they just don't have that type of money, and so they just can't make those type of changes.
You also have the influence of Alice Waters and others that can't be downplayed. What is your advice specifically to the schools and the communities, to come up to these standards? What do they really need to do?
I think there's so many different things that they need to do. I think that a big piece of it is just trying to get involved. I think a lot of the parents and the community members, as your previous guest was saying, it's not just about, what the kids are eating at lunch. A lot of it at school, a lot of it is if the kids are exposed to healthier foods when they're at home, then they'll end up being more open to eating those healthier meals at school. And so if parents can get involved with their kids and try to teach them about eating more fruits and vegetables and try to teach them about, balanced meals, I think that schools will have a much better chance getting kids to choose the healthier options and eat them once they get to schools. And I think if parents get involved and community members get involved, they can say, hey, look at our lunch period. It's too short. Maybe talk to the superintendent or the school board and approach them and say, this is a concern that we have. There's a lot of other pieces at play other than just the finances that I think people can make a difference in if they got involved.
Eleanor Yang Su with us from San Diego is a contributor for California Watch, and they're part of the Center for Investigative Reporting and a KQED news partner. And Eleanor Yang Su, thank you so much for joining us on Forum this morning.
Thanks again.
Joining us for the rest of the hour, Sandip Kaur, who is Acting Director of Nutrition Services Division for the California Department of Education, joining us this morning from the state capitol in Sacramento. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Jennifer Labar for the rest of the hour, who is Nutrition Services Director for the Oakland Unified School District. Jennifer Labar, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let me begin with Sanip Kaur, and I should mention that the Nutrition Services Division, which is part of, as I said, the California Department of Education, oversees all school meals for all of California. That's over 4 million lunches a day in the state and disperses about $1.6 billion in federal funds for state and meal providers. Who are the providers of meals?
Good morning. Thank you for including me in this this program. Well, it's school districts. We administer about 10 state and federal child nutrition programs. So it's more than just about school lunch. It's school breakfast. It's child and adult care food program. That may be small daycare homes. It may be adult care facilities. And we have the summer food service program where Boys and Girls Clubs or the YMCA or faith-based organizations might be providing these nutritious meals to hungry children. We have the summer food service program during the summer when school is out for children to access a healthy meal. So there's a wide variety of programs and meals that are served through these essential food nutrition programs.
So wide spectrum also of just generally meal providers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But you've got now 450 pages of new regulations.
Well, we always had 450 pages, and now they've been tweaked. And we are very excited with the reauthorization and the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act. It does the right thing. It increases the nutrition quality of meals. It gives districts the additional 6 cents in performance-based reimbursements when they meet those new standards. And, you know, it's just a great thing. It is to be celebrated. Plus, in California, as you said, you know, we are ahead of the nation in the quality of meals. But the superintendent of education, Superintendent Tollickson, has also initiated Team California for Healthy Kids. And that aligns perfectly with the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, because the goals are to increase access to and consumption of fresh fruits and vegetables, increase access to fresh drinking water, making water the drink of choice. And the other third leg of a successful strong stool is increasing physical activity throughout the school day.
You know, we did a program last week on picky food eaters, which there are many. And this is actually, in terms of these new regulations, or just it's an ongoing concern, because there are a lot of kids who would rather eat fast food than healthy and wholesome food. And that's a challenge, isn't it?
It is a challenge. And, you know, when we look at some of our communities, obviously not all, fast food becomes the food of choice due to sometimes the socioeconomic background and the location where a family might live or a school might be. And that's why it's even more important that school lunches, school meals be healthy, because that might be the most healthiest meal that the child receives all day.
Well, in terms of keeping up with the new regulations, though, there is on-site visiting, as I indicated earlier when we spoke with Janie Thornton from USDA. The 5 years has been reduced to 3 years, but in terms of making certain that those on-site visits take place and that they take place to the maximum extent, that too represents a major challenge, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And the USDA has provided all states, and California in particular, $6 million to be able to implement the new regulations, to be able to train locals, for states to be able to certify that schools are meeting the new requirements, and then to go out and do validations of the menus at the sites. So, yes, it is a challenge. I don't want to minimize the workload, but it is an exciting time. It's the right thing. And, you know, we have in California over 4,000 reviews that we need to do each year. And to see that maybe we didn't do 100, when you look at it in terms of perspective, I think we're doing a great job. Could we do better? Certainly. And we will be working with the legislature and the Department of Finance to get more resources, because we have the funding. All we will need is the authority to fill more positions as they are needed so that we can do all of our reviews.
And you're going to do more locally raising of produce and other foods?
Yes, we have some training programs that some food service directors stars in this area, the local produce movement, farm to school, school gardens, salad bars. Rodney Taylor in Riverside, he's a star in this area, and many more, Sandy Kerwood, Pilar Gray, Scott Sosuth in Turlock. We have many food service directors who run excellent programs already, and Jennifer Labar is one of them, because in Oakland, I learned, they bring the farmer's market to the school 2 days a week.
Well, let's talk to Jennifer Labar about that. Jennifer Labar is Nutrition Services Director of the Oakland Unified School District, and that program is going quite well, Jennifer Labar?
Yes, we have markets, after-school markets at 22 schools, and they operate right before school gets out to right before the after-school program is ended for the day. And we're bringing in fresh and organic and local produce to what Sandeep referred to, really the food deserts that our children are living in here in Oakland.
This 6 cents additional for each meal, though, doesn't necessarily make up for the kind of cost that you're looking at, does it? There's still a serious revenue problem, deficit.
Well, I think there will be, especially with the issue of children having to take a fresh fruit or vegetable. I think it's going to be an issue for a lot of school districts. I mean, it's certainly something that we're concerned about in Oakland.
Well, and then what about the time element? I'd mentioned when we talked with Janie Thornton about kids having only 25, 30 minutes to eat and the long lines, and the time in, say, shucking corn and shelling peas to make fresh fruits, things of that sort, vegetables?
Well, I think the meal service time is definitely a concern of ours, and one of the ways that we have worked around it at several of our schools is that we do recess before lunch. And what this does is it actually encourages the students. They've gotten their energy out. They've already played. And they come into the cafeteria ready to eat. And we find that at these schools, children are eating a complete meal, including the fresh fruits and vegetables that we're offering. And so that's really helped us out as well. So being more creative with how we're scheduling lunch as opposed to just it being lunch and then going out to recess.
And what do you see as the biggest challenges here? We heard about excess sodium and high fat. Are those the big challenges as you see it?
Fat and sodium aren't too big of a problem for us. We're actually at the point in Oakland where we've had to actually add calories other ways because we've reduced fat so much in our program. We're actually using 100% beef so that we can meet the former standards of fat, but not exceed them. I think sodium will be an issue, though, and I think a lot of our sodium actually comes from salad dressings that our students are using to eat the fresh fruits and vegetables that we're putting on our salad bar. And so trying to work around those types of things are definitely going to be an issue for us, but we have time to do that. The sodium requirements really don't go into effect until the 14-15 school year, so there's time to do lots of change with that.
So you sound pretty bullish and optimistic as well.
Well, I am. I think it's a great program. Janie Thornton has said many times that children eat food. They don't eat calories and vitamin A. So it's good because I think it's going to help us teach our children how to eat so that they're prepared to lead a better, healthy life.
But there is a caloric savings in in this new tweaking of the old regulations. I'm going to open the phone lines, invite those of you listening who have questions or comments to join this conversation. You are certainly welcome to do that now, and our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to join the program at 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, and that's the number to call. 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate with us, and we would like to hear from you, so join the conversation. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On July 1st, new federal regulations went into effect to make your child's school lunch more nutritious, like adding additional fresh fruits and vegetables after the usual pizza and chicken nuggets. It sounds like needed change, but we're asking whether schools are ready, and we're getting a response that suggests that they are and that they're really almost feeling celebratory about these new regulations. According to research done, however, by California Watch, 60% of schools in the state have trouble meeting the old nutrition requirements. And the real question is, how will they get up to speed, particularly when these requirements are in some ways more challenging. We spoke earlier with Janie Thornton from the USDA and Eleanor Yang of Yang Su of California Watch. With us for the hour are Jennifer Labar, who is Nutrition Services Director for the Oakland Unified School District, and Sandy Carr, who is the Acting Director of Nutrition Services Division for the California Department of Education. Let me go to your calls, and we'll go first to Mike in Alameda. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. I'm a teacher here in Alameda, and I see some of the students come back from the cafeteria from lunches, and what usually ends up being the detritus of their meal is these pre-sliced fruit bags. An apple pre-sliced or an orange pre-sliced labeled as Smiles. Not only does it have them not eat the fruit, but then creates more garbage with the cellophane wrapper, and it doesn't seem appetizing at all. I think it's like a one-time use. I mean, even if you wanted to not eat that apple and hand it to a friend as a student, you're kind of lost. You know, it doesn't allow them to turn around and, like, give the apple back. It could be rewashed and reused. There's also things like a look on the menu. It says chicken burrito, and inside is a chicken nugget, you know, with lettuce and a shriveled tomato. Or the one that really caught me the most was when I was helping with the breakfast thing one year. And the breakfast was a high sugar, high fructose juice and a Lucky Charms cereal bar. The best out of the options was a Cheerios bar that it warns you that there's wheat in it. So I can take comments off the air.
Well, let's get some comments from you, Sandip Kaur.
Actually, I might ask Jennifer to handle this call.
Jennifer, want to handle it for us?
Sure. You know, each district handles the meal program regulations differently. And while we may not always agree that a Trix cereal bar is the best possible option for our students, it is something that does meet met the former requirements. But I think it also raises a challenge to us to go above and beyond the requirements as they are. And I think that's something that every school district is working on while trying to be in compliance with the regulations.
Well, here's a point made by a listener that kind of dovetails. This is Helen who writes, I'm a parent of an elementary school-aged child in San Mateo School District and a pediatrician. I'm not sure if the new requirements will address the fact that school lunches are largely composed of processed food, including frozen pizza, oven-baked tater tots, French fries, and canned fruit. When the children's palates become used to the taste of processed food, it's more difficult to convince them steamed broccoli actually tastes good. You say what to that, Jennifer Labar?
Well, I think a lot of our problem are facilities. We have not paid as much attention to the National School Lunch Program as we should have. A lot of times it's really seen as an interruption in the school day, as opposed to being a crucial element to the child's academic and life success. So I think it behooves the community and parents, like your listener from San Mateo, to really put some emphasis when working with the school district to bring facilities back to our schools so that we can properly prepare the meals for our children.
And here's, before I go to more calls, here's another question from a listener sent to us by email, and you can email your questions or comments into us simply at forum@kqed.org. And Sandip Kaur, I want to go to you on this. Listener Emma says, our school contracts with a for-profit organization for meals. How do organizations ensure that quality is not compromised when dealing with providers whose motivation is making money at the least cost possible?
Well, really, they have to know the contractor or the vendor that they're dealing with. And if it's a food service management company contract, those are up for renewal every year. So if a district is not getting high-quality foods, you know, for what it's costing them, they have an option. Schools have an option then to get out of that contract.
Well, let me go to more of our callers, and we'll go next to you, John. You're on.
I just had a question. Just giving kids better food to eat is great, but are kids being taught why they need to eat more nutritious meals? I mean, it seems like education is really important, even if, you know, they have to hear a story from Antioxidant Al or something like that.
Well, how goes the education of nutrition in the schools in Oakland, Jennifer Labar?
Well, we're really really fortunate in that 37 of our schools, we have the Harvest of the Month education program in partnership with the Alameda County Public Health Department. And through that program, we're actually able to provide nutrition lessons and actually samples of different fruits and vegetables that are available seasonally in Oakland itself. And so at those schools, it's really a marked difference with the schools that don't have that program. At the schools where we do have it, children are more likely to take and actually consume the fresh fruits and vegetables that they're offered compared to those other schools. So nutrition education really does make a difference.
And I need to make a correction. I said in my introduction that the school lunch program serves about 32 million lunches annually. In fact, about 32 million children participate in school meal programs each day, and that's according to USDA. I wanted to get that on the record and thank a listener named Eric for catching my error. Let me go to more of your calls, and Shannon is next. Shannon, you're on.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a parent from San Ramon Valley Unified, and I've tried to push for a couple of years now for better, healthier lunches. And a couple of quick points. You know, you can add fruits and vegetables to the salad bar, but the meat quality in our district anyways is still horrendous. Kids are forced to take fruits and vegetables, but most of that ends up in the trash can. We make these beautiful salads, and then we put them next to popcorn, chicken, and mac and cheese, so we don't sell any of the salads. Kids can go back for seconds, so I don't know about the portion control part of it. And specifically, you know, what I've heard directly from people is, you know, if we put food out that's too healthy, we're not going to sell any lunches, and it's all about money.
Well, let me get some response from you on that, Jennifer Labar. Again, we get to the point of the profiteering behind this or the profits behind this and the fact that kids prefer fast food often.
Well, I think a lot of our students do prefer fast food over what we would consider healthy options. But it's our job as a district to educate our students as to what those healthy options are. And it's my mantra is slow and steady wins the race. And so it's something where we have to constantly chip away at our competition, which are the fast food restaurants. And I wouldn't say that we are worried about the almighty dollar all the time. We're not trying to make a profit, but we are within an education system where one of our number one priorities is to at least break even as a meal program. We do not want to what's called encroach on the general fund, which means that the general fund, which pays for teacher salaries and books and buildings for our children, is then taken and putting into food. So it's this constant competition that we have between just breaking even and then providing the meals that we want our children to eat and them actually eating them. So that's one of the tensions that we have to deal with as food service directors.
But you also have what the caller brought attention to, the sense that a lot of kids are just throwing away their food. They're not eating the nutritious food. Good salads are made and they're not eating.
And I think that has a lot to do with a combination of not wanting to eat them, but also not having time to eat them as well. It takes longer to eat a salad than it does a popcorn chicken. So those are some of the issues that we're dealing with. And if we can get longer lunch periods or be creative with how we're scheduling lunch, I think it helps to address that.
Is there also we spoke about the high sodium problem. Doesn't that go along sometimes with the salads?
Definitely it does because of the salad dressing. So we have to put pressure on industry to create low sodium salad dressings, and that's what we're working on.
Well, let's work on some more calls, and we'll go to Los Altos and welcome Kim. You're on the air. Hi. Kim? From Los Altos. No? All right. Let me go to another caller then, and that's you, Renee. Hi.
Hi. This is Renee. I've got a comment. I took over the snack shack for Menlo Atherton football, and we only serve healthy food. All of our hamburger meat is organic, our hot dogs are nitrate-free, all beef. We sell out of salads every game. We sell fresh fruit, a fresh fruit salad. All of our, I bake everything, all of our, so I'm able to keep the sugar and the salt.
Are you suggesting if you can do it, the schools can do it?
Yeah, and I just sell water. I don't sell candy or soda, and it's been a great success. We've actually made a lot of money for the football team. So it's doable. It does take, you know, a lot of manpower. So, but the kids, you know, they eat everything. It seems as long as it's you know, presented to them.
Well, when they're watching football, particularly, they get hungry. You know?
Yeah, they get hungry, but usually at a football game, you'd get a soda and, you know, some candy. And, you know, our snacks are fresh popcorn. And so it is, the kids do eat the healthy food.
If it's there for them.
If it's there for them.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that, Renee. Good to hear from you, and we'll hear from more of our callers. We'll go to Jennifer next. You're on. Good morning, Jennifer.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a great program.
Thank you.
I had a question about school gardens. So several of your guests have mentioned that if we can sort of extend this to the home, and that it's not just about healthy eating at school, but it's at home, and if it comes from the family table, they're going to, you know, if the family table supports healthy eating, then they'll be more likely to choose nutritious foods at school. And I think another piece of that puzzle is the garden. So kids who grow their own food are more likely to choose healthy foods. And I'm curious if your guest can talk a little bit about how school gardens are working with school cafeterias to help kind of create this healthy lunch.
Well, let's find out what we're doing in Oakland on that score. Jennifer Labar?
Sure. We actually developed a program called Oakland Eats Garden Fresh, which ties in what the Harvest of the Month program is doing in the classroom to what we're doing in the cafeteria, but it's starting with what the school gardens are doing. So our ideal goal is that our school gardens are planting and harvesting those Harvest of the Month produce items in time for it to be discussed in the classroom, and then we're then serving it in the cafeteria as well. And we're also working on getting some regulations that our public health department will approve so that we can purchase the produce that's grown in the gardens to be used in our cafeteria program. That's where we are in Oakland, but a lot of other school districts are already at that point, and now we're just working with the public health department to get us there, too.
And again, Jennifer Labar is Nutrition Services Director with the Oakland Unified School District. What about, do we know, Sandeep Kaur, about other schools on this score with gardens?
Yes, there's many schools. Manteca Unified has a school garden. Again, going back down south to Riverside, Rodney Taylor's area, they have a huge garden program. So there are many schools already doing that, but, you know, many that don't. So it is a program that we do want to expand, and the Department of Education is on a task force to increase farm-to-school and school garden programs. So we're going to be working closely with the Department of Food and Agriculture and the Department of Public Health. So that's part of our Health in All Policies task force to curb the obesity epidemic.
Well, let me thank Jennifer for the call. And speaking about the obesity epidemic, here's Sophia who writes, I'm a pediatrician. It works at Stanford Pediatric Weight Clinic, which evaluates morbidity obese patients for comorbidities and possibly bariatric surgery. And she wants to know what the status is of juice in schools and fatty and flavored milk in schools. Her mantra is, eat your fruit, don't drink it. Ounce per ounce, there are more calories in juice than soda. And I have had a really difficult time getting non-fat milk for my patients in Redwood City and would love to talk about school breakfast. What about the options there? It seems only unhealthy options. Some comments from you, Sandeep Kaur?
Well, there are new regulations for the breakfast program, part of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, but those will be phased in next school year, so July 2013. In terms of the, I'm looking up my notes here for milk, only fat-free, unflavored or flavored, and unflavored low-fat milk is allowed. So it has to be fat-free or unflavored low-fat milk. Those are the requirements for the milk in schools.
What about her point about juice, though? When she says that ounce per ounce there are more calories in juice than soda, I think she's right.
Jennifer, can you help me with that one, since you're on the ground doing this?
So we're definitely concerned about juice as well, and that's why we limit it to at lunchtime once a week for our students as the fruit option, because we do believe it's better to eat your fruit than to drink it. But we also have students who don't want to eat fruit, so we're trying to make sure that they get some sort of fruit that's available to them that they'll actually consume. Where we have a bigger problem is at breakfast, and that is something that we're trying to work on. We're offering fresh fruit every day, but we're also offering juice as an option. Then we also have a large lactose intolerant population in Oakland, and so juice becomes the beverage of choice along with water.
And Jennifer, if I might, could you tell me, are there any regulations about the treats or snacks that parents give their kid to bring to school?
Well, that's going to vary from district to district, but and according to the district's wellness policy. But we do say in Oakland that no candy should be served at all to our students, along with no sodas as part of celebrations or any treats.
So that means if they take out some candy in the cafeteria or at lunch, essentially you don't tolerate it?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's something that we really ask our parents not to do, and it's really something that takes away from the lunch period as well when we see soda and candy that parents are sending.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go to Cindy next. Cindy, join us.
Hi, this is, am I on?
You're on.
Hi, Cindy. I mean, this is Cindy. I'm a sub in the San Ramon Unified School District, and I see lots of different programs here in kids, and I've noticed that a lot of the younger kids, when they bring snacks for their first recess, and they're starving by that time, they get, like, stickers if they have healthy snacks. And it just, I am so impressed with the fruit that kids bring, or seaweed, or all kinds of really great snacks that they bring. Not so much the heavy cookies and stuff like that anymore. So that's when they get the nice reward. The stickers, so it really seems to work.
You're talking about what age kids, Cindy?
Well, elementary school.
Yeah.
Starting in kindergarten and on up.
And love those stickers, huh?
They love those stickers. Unbelievable. Love them.
Okay. Thank you for that. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's hear next from Kirsten in Oakland. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you. Okay.
Good morning. This is Kirsten Toby. I'm one of the co-founders of Revolution Foods, and we serve healthy, fresh meals to kids in Oakland and throughout Northern California. And I just wanted to say, well, first of all, thank you to everyone who's commented. I missed the first part of the show, but just really great input, and wanted to just share a little bit about Revolution Foods and what we're doing with providing healthy, fresh, and affordable food meals that include breakfast, lunch, after-school snack, and suppers to kids in schools throughout Northern California. Two-thirds of the kids that we serve are from low-income families and qualify for free and reduced-price lunches at school. So I think it's been really interesting hearing the dialogue around whether healthy and fresh necessarily is accessible to kids, you know, of low-income backgrounds. And we have found that that it's definitely possible to make a healthy, fresh meal that kids will be able to afford, whether they qualify for a free lunch or whether they have to pay for lunch at school.
Well, keep up the revolution, and thank you for the call. I think it was Tom Letty who said on the air here that Alice Waters started really the only revolution that took hold in the 60s, and that was the food revolution. I want to get to more of your calls in a moment, but I've got a listener, Eric, who says, and let me go to you, Sandeep Kaur, on this. I wish you'd investigate Berkeley school lunches a bit more. From my understanding, it is no better, even worse than some other districts. Alice Waters Garden is at one school, not district-wide. When I worked in Berkeley at Rosa Parks School, the food came in disposable plastic trays sealed with plastic. I'd like to see schools go back to having full-staff cafeterias and use reusable silverware and trays. You want to comment, well, not only on that sense of the plastic, but also Berkeley specifically, because we heard from Janie Thornton, who joined us earlier from USDA, that Berkeley is the shining star here.
You know, Berkeley is the shining star, but as I said earlier, other districts are doing a great job also. And I, too, would love to see kitchen cafeterias come back to school so that, you know, our food service directors at the local level are very passionate about providing healthy, nutritious, appealing meals. But again, like we discussed earlier, their hands are tied if they don't have the facilities, they don't have the equipment, they don't have the staffing, perhaps. So, yes, bringing, you know, kitchens back to schools would be a great thing. It would be a move in the right direction.
Another listener, Diane, writes, while reduced sodium and saturated fats intake are essential to a healthier diet, I'm hearing very little reference to reduced added sugars. What is the new sugar reduction? Can you help us here again, Sandeep Kaur?
Jennifer, I'm going to ask you to take that one.
Well, I think the sugar reductions are really coming from just the reduction in calories is one of the ways that we're having to do that. But one of the things that we have done in Oakland is, for example, with cereals, we've adopted the WIC standard so that no more than 6 grams of sugar per serving are served to our students. Then we've also worked with our milk company to reduce the sugar in chocolate milk, which a lot of school districts have adopted as well. And then also addressing high fructose corn syrup and eliminating that from our options is key as well.
Well, here's Therese from Los Altos, and perhaps, Jennifer, you can take this as well. It says, as a teacher, I know that in our local districts, cooking is not done on site, but rather food comes in prepackaged servings from another center. As a child growing up in the 50s, I remember the smell of lunches that were prepared wafting through the school late in the mornings. That stimulated our appetites for foods that were different than we ate at home. Most of the students were first generation. Why is so little cooking done on site?
Well, about 20 years ago, there was a shift in the industry, a lot of it having to do with the cost of employees with the salaries and benefits, to move to a centralized preparation facility where it was necessary for everything to be also individually prepackaged and sent out to schools. And so what we're seeing now is the pendulum swinging back. So what is old is new again, and a lot of people are trying to utilize their facilities better and to start cooking from scratch or freshly preparing food. So I think that she will start seeing a change as well. But it also has to do with facilities. So the National School Lunch Act wasn't started until 1946, and a lot of the school districts, especially in urban settings like in Oakland, were built without kitchens. So there's not even a facility to cook in if we wanted to. So there's going to be a great number of schools who will not have a cooking facility, but I still don't think that limits us from getting better food to our children. So one of the things that we're doing in Oakland is we want to build a new central kitchen, which will then allow us to serve bulk food to our schools instead of having the individually prepackaged portions wrapped in plastic.
Well, in fact, here's a lot of listeners expressing this concern. Tony writes, my elementary school tries to be healthy by using organic versions, the standard fast food fare, corn dogs, pizza, burgers, and mac and cheese, this greenwashing teaching my kid that the hot dog is a healthy alternative to cooked meals. The principal, a bona fide foodie, tells us that she can't change the menu even if she wanted to because the school lost its kitchen 20 years ago to save money and to maximize efficiency. Bring back the kitchen, the lunch lady, and student helpers. We're going to go to more of your calls and actually, somebody asked about Berkeley, and here's Bonnie, who is executive chef of school lunches at Berkeley. Hi.
Hi. So there are a few things I want to say. I've been listening to the program, and first of all, you can't make these changes overnight. So facilities is a huge issue. It took 8 years for us to build our new central kitchen. We don't serve food in individual plastic containers. We do serve it all in bulk. But again, it takes a lot of time to be able to do that because you have to train staff. You have to hire staff. You have to outfit all the school kitchens. Changing over from processed foods. And Berkeley, we do everything from raw, so we get all our raw meats in. We get raw fruits and vegetables in, all of that sort of stuff. These kinds of changes don't happen overnight. So, they're talking, I want to see this right now. When a school district decides that this is what they want to do, they need all the parents on board, they need the superintendent on board, they need administration on board, they need local businesses and community members on board to make these kinds of things happen. There is a lot of dissent over how to make this all happen. And then you have to hire professionals to implement it. School districts are in the business of educating children. They're not in the business of food service and handling foods from raw and serving, 3,000 lunches a day is no easy task. I'm a restaurant chain chef. I worked in restaurants my entire life. I worked in 3- and 4-star restaurants in New York City. Doing bulk food for 3,000 kids, we do 3,000 lunches, we do 8,000 breakfasts a day. Very, very different from serving up lunches. Alice Waters is not involved in our program, and our program is not funded by private donors. We have to stand on our own. We do not encroach on the general fund, But again, when we first started this program, in order to implement all of these changes, we did encroach on the general fund. It costs a huge amount of money. It was a huge effort to get in all the new equipment, refrigeration, all of that stuff that you need to house, warehouse all of those foods. And then, of course, to develop menus, you know, getting in things that kids like to eat. That's an ongoing project.
Well, you've mentioned a lot of concerns here and touched on them, and I appreciate that because I think they need to be cataloged here. I would also just urge everybody who's listening that the home has to be really providing more help here in terms of healthy meals that are nutritious. Parents need to be taking more responsibility. I'm getting a lot of emails that are pretty much highlighting that. And Bonnie, I thank you for the call. In fact, there's another email. Craig writes, so far I've heard very little about perhaps the biggest threat to health and cause of obesity in America, sugar, and specifically the ubiquitous high fructose corn sugar. But we do really need efforts on not only on the schools, and we've got certainly the revenue concerns and all this as a part of the equation as well, but more awareness in the community. And I hope that this hour is bringing that because we're talking about our children and our future here. And I want to extend thanks to all who participated in this hour. And we hope that you will look over some of these new regulations. We have them online, I think, through the USDA. You can find them, 450 pages. Janie Thornton joined us earlier, Deputy Undersecretary of the USDA's Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services. We also talked with Eleanor Yang Su from California Watch. And thanks to you, Sandeep Kerr, joined us from Sacramento, Acting Director of Nutrition Services Division for the California Department of Education. Appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Jennifer Labar, from the Oakland Unified School District, Nutrition Services Director.
You're welcome, and thanks for talking about this great topic.
And thank you all for being a part of this hour of Forum. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, Amy Machado. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, remind you another hour up ahead. Thank you for being with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.